And they were objected to. The agents present at the polling station objected to the persons who voted on the list. Yes, on the basis of personation, elector not residing in the constituency, elector not qualified for registration, elector not being physically impaired but requesting assistance from a third party while voting. I repeat the point made above, that on election days, the registers are conclusive of the rights of the persons registered there on the vote. Electoral officials were obliged to allow these persons to vote. Again, the petitioners or the agents may have required that the voters take a note. There is no such pleading. Objections could have been made at various counts. The petitioners have not alluded to any actions being taken at the counts. More importantly, and almost repetitively at this point, the pleadings fail to include particulars that may assist to identify whether the claim breaches or irregularities affected or may have affected the outcome of the elections. For instance, other than a list of names, there is no information as to the basis on which the objections were made to any of the listed names. By way of example, are the respondents to wait trial to find out and verify which of the listed names resided out of the constituency? How are the respondents to answer the accuracy or not of the bland assertions without the necessary details? In paragraph 30, the petitioners claim that Linda George and Diane Hippolyte were allowed by the poll clerk and presiding officer to vote in the constituency despite the fact that the name were not on the register of electors used by the polling clerks. I will strike out this paragraph for the reasons stated above. Additionally, even if true and the votes of Linda George and Diana Hippolyte are awarded to Mr. Coffey, the pleadings have little chance in succeeding in setting aside the election of Mrs. Kerry. Billboard advertisement. The petitioner's charge in paragraphs 31 to 32 of the petition that Mrs. Kerry and her agents allowed an LCC billboard to advertise political propaganda on polling day with slogans such as "It's safer with labor," "With an X by a shoe." They state that this billboard, which is in 100 yards of the Windsor Park Stadium, polling station, which unduly influenced hundreds of voters to vote for her and gave her an unfair advantage, rendering her return undue, null and void. With respect, I cannot see how this pleading passes muster. Sections 25 and 54 of the Elections Act are relevant here. The taking of a poll of the poll at an election in Dominica shall take place between the hours of 7 o'clock in the morning and 5 o'clock of the afternoon of the same day, section 25. During the hours that the polls are open, it is an offense to seek to influence a voter to vote for a candidate or to ascertain for whom a voter intends to vote or has voted. The Act prohibits a person from engaging in this conduct on any public road or place within 100 yards of any building in which polling is taking place, section 54. If the allegation is true, and I am to assume for the purposes of a striking out discourse that it is true, then Mrs. Skevitt's billboard should have been taken down by 7 o'clock on the 6th of December, 7 o'clock of the morning of 6th of December 2019. If true, the period within which the billboard remained there constitutes an offense under Section 54 of the Act. Again, the petitioner's plea without more that the commission of the offense renders her return null and void. But how is this the case? I've deliberately set out in extensive form the law on what constitutes the basis on which a court ought to set aside an election. It's not simply the assertion that an election's offense has been committed. Radix versus Gary Morgan versus Simpson, Frampton, and the line of authorities recited above all struck that the petitioners were enjoined to show whether and how the alleged infraction affected the results or rendered the same undue or unsafe or a sham or travesty or any of the multitude of descriptions of outcomes that would impel a court to set aside an election result. There's no such information available here. For instance, the petitioners contend that hundreds of persons were unduly influenced. One would assume that they did not make this assertion lightly, but rather they proposed it on their petition following some of their own diligent scrutiny or research. Yet they have not identified one person on the petition who was influenced by the petition. It begs the question, how many persons were influenced? One? Or was it 200 or 300? Mrs. Skerritt won by over 200 votes. Even if the allegation is true, on what basis can it be said that the results were indeed affected by the infraction? I'm of the view that this sort of pleading was necessary. I'm careful after arriving at this conclusion. Careful because I'm mindful that the petitioners are entitled to bring evidence to substantiate their contentions. But I cannot agree that the petitioners will know the case that they have to answer if there is at least some factual basis set out on the pleadings to show not only a breach of the law, but how that breach affected the election's results. Disqualification of Mrs. Skerritt as a member of parliament. In paragraph 82, Mrs. Coffey, George, and Robin allege that Mrs. Skerritt is a citizen of Canada and a holder of a Canadian passport. The petition recites the 25th January 2019, 27th March 2019, and 1st April 2019 as dates on which Mrs. Skerritt traveled on her Canadian passport. Mrs. Skerritt is said to be, by her act of traveling using her Canadian passport, on the acknowledgement of allegiance, obedience, and adherence to a foreign power or state, namely Canada, and therefore disqualified from being elected to Parliament. Applicant's rejoinder is that this pleading should be struck out because the petitioners failed to plead the foreign law and the material facts allegedly committed by Mrs. Skerritt. The petitioners answer the applicant's charge by saying that they were not obligated to plead the foreign law. They say the pleadings are adequate since they allege that Mrs. Skerritt holds a Canadian passport and she traveled on the passport in 2019. The petitioners say that the applicants know the case they have to answer. The law in Dominica on this issue should be uncontroversial by now. On that score, Section 32(1)(a) of the Dominica Constitution reads, "A person shall not be qualified to be elected or appointed as a representative or senator if he or she A is by virtue of his own act under any acknowledgement of allegiance, obedience, or adherence to a foreign power or state." The question of whether a claimant, or in this case petitioner, ought to plead and prove foreign law on a question arising as to the qualification of a member pursuant to this very section of the Dominica Constitution has also been definitively pronounced upon by our Court of Appeal. In Ronald Green et al. Versus St. Jean and Skerritt, Her Ladyship Dame Janice Pereira wrote for the majority that in this case, the burden was therefore on the appellants. Having pleaded the provision above, which on the authorities are accepted by this court, brings into play foreign law, to have brought the necessary evidence before the court to prove that under the law of France, that the voluntary act done by the respondents, hence the alleged possession of French passport, particularly where it is accepted that mere possession of a French passport may not have been on the basis of voluntary act of possessor, was an act which amounted to an acknowledgement of allegiance, obedience, or adherence to the state of France. This was not done. The applicants were aware of the many authorities which support this finding, but choose not to plead and produce evidence which would prove the principles of foreign law, which would disqualify the respondents under Section 32(1)(a). Father, they will allow life to this issue during other interlocutory hearings in this case. Having failed to specifically plead and prove the disqualifying factors, they are unable to now rely on the fallback presumption, which in my view simply cannot suffice in the face of a constitutional provision to which high regard must be given in the view of the impact it may have on the democratic process in the election. The petitioners failed to plead the alleged foreign law. Accordingly, the defective paragraph 82 does not meet the required test to set out a cause of action and is struck out. I would, for completeness, state that the Denzel Douglas decision relied on by the petitioners is not helpful because the question of foreign law was not under review. In this case, the petitioners raise issues of foreign law. They must plead and prove the same. St. Joseph petition, paragraphs 20 and 21 of this petition allege that Kevin King was allowed to vote despite the fact that he did not reside in the constituency. Objection was made to his voting, but this was ignored. Kevin King is said to be the son of Addis King, who was declared the winning candidate of the St. Joseph's election. The pleading fails and is struck out because there is no detail as to when the objection was taken. The list is conclusive as to the persons registered thereon, and electoral officials could not refuse to permit Mr. King to a ballot to vote. It does not demonstrate that the conduct of electoral officials amounted to an election offense or irregularity that affected the outcome of the election or rendered the same a sham. Outcome, finally. Even though I find that all of the respondents, except DBS, were properly joined, the pleadings against all of them are inadequate or insufficient. In my reasons above, I have set out how they fail for reasons of not disclosing a cause of action, lack of necessary details, and their specificity. The pleadings have therefore been struck out. A ruling on the applications and arguments about service of the petitions is therefore pointless. Costs. In relation to costs, the courts are usually hesitant to award costs on election petitions. However, I find good reason to depart from these general principles on these applications to strike out the petitions. A cursory reading of the petitions discloses that the petitioners have repeated most of the contentions verbatim on all 10 petitions. The petitioners could have easily placed these averments on one or at the most two petitions. The cost and expense of responding to 10 petitions was, in my view, unnecessarily and somewhat unmindfully imposed on the applicants. They were constrained to file applications to strike out 10 different petitions in circumstances where a majority of the complaints could have been easily subsumed under a single or at the most two petitions. I award the sum of $5,000 as cost to the applicants. Conclusion. For the reasons stated above, I order as follows. All 10 of the petitions are hereby struck out for the reasons set out in this judgment. Claimants, the respondents or the applicant respondents or the applicants are awarded cost in the sum of $5,000. Now, as you note, as I was going along, I'm stopping to make a lot of typographical changes. I will endeavor my best to get these sorted out, judgment formatted, and sent to you at least before the week is over or by Monday latest. Thank you all very much for your patience in hearing these matters.